so that she never had any illusions about the rest of the family. But in any case, she had the right to expect a little more consideration from her husband, because, for better or for worse, he was her consecrated spouse, her helpmate, her legal despoiler, who took upon himself of his own free and sovereign will the grave responsibility of taking her away from her paternal home, where she never wanted for or suffered from anything, where she wove funeral wreaths as a pastime, since her godfather had sent a letter with his signature and the stamp of his ring on the sealing wax, simply to say that the hands of his goddaughter were not meant for tasks of this world, except to play the clavichord. And nevertheless, her insane husband had taken her from her home with all manner of admonitions and warnings, and had brought her to that frying pan of hell where a person could not breathe because of the heat. And before she had completed her Pentecostal fast, he had gone off with his wandering trunks and his wastrel's accordion to loaf in adultery with a wretch of whom it was only enough to see her behind. Well, that's been said, to see her wiggle her mare's behind in order to guess that she was just the opposite of her, who was a lady in a palace or a pigsty, at the table or in bed, a lady of breeding, God-fearing, obeying his laws and submissive to his wishes, and with whom he could not perform, naturally, the acrobatics and trampish antics that he did with the other one, who, of course, was ready for anything, like the French matrons, and even worse, if one considers well, because they at least had the honesty to put a red light at their door. Swinishness like that, just imagine! And that was all that was needed by the only and beloved daughter of Doña Renata Argote and Don Fernando del Carpio, and especially the latter, an upright man, a fine Christian, a knight of the Order of the Holy Sepulchre. Those who receive direct from God the privilege of remaining intact in their graves, with their skin smooth like the cheeks of a bride, and their eyes alive and clear like emeralds. That's not true, Aureliano II interrupted her. He was already beginning to smell when they brought him here. He had the patience to listen to her for a whole day until he caught her in a slip. Fernanda did not pay him any mind, but she lowered her voice. That night at dinner, the exasperating buzzing of the sing-song had conquered the sound of the rain. Aureliano II ate very little, with his head down, and he went to his room early. At breakfast on the following day, Fernanda was trembling, with a look of not having slept well, and she seemed completely exhausted by her rancor. Nevertheless, when her husband asked if it was not possible to have a soft-boiled egg, she did not answer simply that they had run out of eggs the week before, but she worked up a violent diatribe against men who spent their time contemplating their navels and then had the gall to ask for lark's livers at the table. Aureliano II took the children to look at the encyclopedia, as always, and Fernanda pretended to straighten out Meme's room just so that he could listen to her muttering, of course, that it certainly took cheek for him to tell the poor innocents that there was a picture of Colonel Aureliano Buendía in the encyclopedia. During the afternoon, while the children were having their nap, Aureliano II sat on the porch, and Fernanda pursued him even there, provoking him, tormenting him, hovering about him with her implacable horsefly buzzing, saying that, of course, while there was nothing to eat except stones, her husband was sitting there like a sultan of Persia watching it rain, because that was all he was, a slob, a sponge, a good-for-nothing, softer than cotton batting, used to living off women and convinced that he had married Jonah's wife, who was so content with the story of the whale. Aureliano II listened to her for more than 2 hours, impassive, as if he were deaf. He did not interrupt her until late in the afternoon, when he could no longer bear the echo of the bass drum that was tormenting his head. "Please shut up," he begged. Fernanda, quite the contrary, raised her pitch. "I don't have any reason to shut up," she said. "Anyone who doesn't want to listen to me can go someplace else." Then Aureliano II lost control. He stood up unhurriedly, as if he only intended to stretch, and with a perfectly regulated and methodical fury, he grabbed the pots with the begonias, one after the other, those with the ferns, the oregano, and one after the other he smashed them onto the floor. Fernanda was frightened, because until then she had not really had a clear indication of the tremendous inner force of her sing-song, but it was too late for any attempt at rectification. Intoxicated by the uncontained torrent of relief, Aureliano II broke the glass on the china closet and piece by piece, without hurrying, he took out the chinaware and shattered it on the floor. Systematically, serenely, in the same parsimonious way in which he had papered the house with banknotes, he then set about smashing the Bohemian crystal ware against the walls, the hand-painted vases, the pictures of maidens in flower-laden boats, the mirrors in their gilded frames, everything that was breakable, from parlor to pantry, and he finished with the large earthen jar in the kitchen, which exploded in the middle of the courtyard with a hollow boom. Then he washed his hands, threw the oilcloth over himself, and before midnight he returned with a few strings of dried meat, several bags of rice, corn with weevils, and some emaciated bunches of bananas. From then on, there was no more lack of food.